Splendid Table is brought to you by all the chickens at Locally Laid Egg Company. Producing high-quality, delicious eggs for over a decade, Locally Laid prioritizes good lives for their hens. Locally Laid Egg Company also partners with rural farmers to keep agriculture clucking along in Minnesota. Locally sourced, locally sold, that's Locally Laid. You can learn more about visiting the flock at the farm's Airbnb at locallylaid.com.
Hi, it's Lynn Rossetto Casper, and you're listening to The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. Our program is produced by American Public Media. Well, today it's a question I've been dying to ask. In all the years that stubborn, opinionated, uncompromising, iconoclast cheesemonger Steve Jenkins has been on the show, I've never asked him how he began. Now, it was long, long ago when cheese was yellow or white, cottage or cream, and artisan simply meant weird. Well, Steve Jenkins' book is The Food Life. Cookbook author and equipment maven Dory Greenspan has just fallen in love with a new gadget. Well, for her, it's been around for about 12,000 years. The veggie burger is put to the test in my kitchen. It's a blind tasting. Food expert Gene Anderson recreates an old-time Southern picnic. And as always in the second half of the show, we're going to be opening the lines for your calls. Now, you can get to us at 800-537-5252. So let's get started with Jane and Michael Stern. They write the Road Food column in Gourmet Magazine.
Lynn, there's a restaurant in Portland, Oregon, the name of which is Halibut's. And indeed, the halibut there that Jane and I have had is very, very good. However, the thing that's going to make us keep coming back is the salmon. And we knew that the moment we walked in the door, because on one side of the restaurant, there was owner and cook Dave McKay with a great big hunk of Copper River salmon that he was about to cut into pieces for broiling, grilling, or, oddly enough, deep frying. Now, you wouldn't think of such
a wonderful... Yep.
Yes. You wouldn't... Like, a wonderful piece of salmon, like Copper River salmon. You know, that's like from that really cold river in Alaska.
Yeah.
You wouldn't think that you would want to deep fry it. But let me tell you, the way it is done at Halibut's, the crust around the salmon is pretty fragile and pretty thin, and it really adds little more than just a kind of luscious crunch. And, you know, the deep frying cooks the meat fast enough so that it retains that kind of juicy, oily salmon flavor.
This guy's a genius at frying. I mean, truly, the halibut, which he makes into the best fish and chips in the West, is even something that I, who...
hate fish. You don't like fish, Jane. Right?
Actually could take a bite of. It's really, really good.
And, of course, halibut, you know, it doesn't have that assertive flavor that salmon does.
Yeah,
but, in fact,
yeah,
it's delicacy. I mean, because the deep-fried crust that this guy puts on it is so kind of almost ephemeral, you really do taste that kind of creaminess of the halibut, just as you would if it was poached, but somehow even better, you know, because it's encased in this crust.
You know, so many seafood restaurants are these big kind of hanging over the water places.
Yeah.
Halibut's is a really little storefront with one man who is Dave McKay, who's the chef, who is just fanatical about everything he does. It's a very sleeves-up eatery, nothing fancy,
mm-hmm,
but he makes the best Dungeness crab cakes and these wonderful fish chips and chowder meals, which is Pacific Northwest chowder, the sort of thick, milky chowder with clams cut into it, and it's just
and
delicious.
Tons and tons of smoky bacon flavor.
Mm.
That's what makes that Northwest chowder unique. I mean, it's clam chowder, but it's got that really unctuous pig flavor to it.
What is the place like?
It's like a bar, really. It's a very casual kind of eatery bar. There's blues music playing on the speakers, or they actually have it performed live many nights. They've got a long list of kind of whoop-de-doo cocktails, you know, the ultimate margarita, Mai Tais.
Mm-hmm.
They were serving one called a lemon drop the day we stopped in, which was fresh-squeezed lemons, citron, absolute citron, triple sec, Bacardi, limon, sweet and sour mix, sugar, and it's all served in one of these kind of goofy stemmed martini glasses,
with this sort of twisted
stem that looks like a martini glass after you've had too many martinis.
I know this sounds disgusting, but I actually dipped a piece of crab cake into the lemon drop, and it was very good.
Hey, guys, thank you.
Bye-bye, Lynn.
Bye, Lynn.
Well, stick shifts and safety belts, bucket seats have all got to go when we're driving in the car. It makes my baby seem so far. I need you here with me.
Jane and Michael Stern are the authors of Two for the Road. Now, you can hear the Sterns here every week, but you can check out their food finds anytime you want. Just go to the website, splendidtable.org. I am hot off the road from Eden in Iowa. That is the annual Seed Savers meeting in Decorah, and I am imbued. I got religion. I mean me, the person whose only talent is growing weeds and a few herbs. Well, I am inspired to actually plant seeds, as in vegetable seeds. Now, let me explain. Seed Savers Heritage Farm is the center for food seed swapping for the nation's farmers and gardeners. It's a seed bank with over 24,000 seeds, a center for biodiversity, and literally a living museum because those seeds are actually grown out on the farm. Now, people drawn to this place run from casual cooks and hobby gardeners to food and gardening professionals, farmers, and scholars. Well, one of the people I met is John Swenson, a gentleman scholar. And thanks to him, I saw what the first corn and chilies on the planet looked like. Seed Savers is growing out the seeds that he's corralled from expeditions to Latin America. And John also shared a paper on recent explorations that revealed that our ancestors grew grains and made flatbread 23,000 years ago. Now, that's about 10,000 years before scientists thought that humans knew agriculture. Now, for me, the history groupie, I mean, this is very hot stuff. All that talk, though, of history, science, and botany was wonderful, but I have to tell you, so was the bean salad served at dinner. Now, you will find my rendition of it, cumin-scented summer beans and new garlic and mint, on the website, splendidtable.org. Award-winning cookbook author Dori Greenspan cannot resist trying out kitchen equipment. She's always test-driving something new and analyzing its pros and cons. Dori, good to have you back.
Good to be with you again.
You know, Dori, I've rediscovered my mortar and pestle. Do you use one?
I have a confession to make. I only really started using a mortar and pestle a few months ago, really. I've had one ever since I've had a kitchen, which is for more than 30 years, and I never used it. And I think I didn't use it because I didn't have the right one.
Did you have one of those little ones?
That's exactly right. I had one of those little ones, very pretty, green marble. But, you know, small doesn't work with a mortar and pestle. I got myself a really big, it holds more than 3 cups, a Thai granite mortar and pestle. And that makes all the difference because things don't fly out of it.
Right.
And it means you really can make a big bowl of pesto. It means you really can put a lot of mint leaves in and just work them. So that big really makes a difference. And it's weighty, so it doesn't jump over the counter in any way. You don't have to really hold it down. I often put a dish towel under it because mine is a very rough granite just to protect the counter. But that roughness is important, too, because it helps grind the ingredients.
Yeah.
I use my food processor a whole lot less because I have this mortar and pestle now.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you put something in a food processor, and it's real – and I'm never giving up my processor. And it's really efficient, but that's it. It's efficient. It's a machine. When you put lime zest and lime juice and salt and coriander and onions and jalapeno peppers and garlic into – a mortar and pestle and you start grinding, the smell is so fabulous. It's really, it's such a pleasure to use it. And it's fast. And so when I'm making guacamole, I'm putting all of those things into the mortar and pestle and just grinding and going around, getting that fabulous flavor, getting not quite a paste because the onions and the jalapeno peppers won't, I don't really want them as a paste, but I'm just getting all of their volatile oils, all of their flavors out. Then I'm putting in the avocado and then I stop. Then I use the edge of a wooden spoon and I just pound it so I get something chunky. Mm-hmm. But the experience of using a mortar and pestle, of making a hummus, of grinding nuts or seeds or spices, it's such a pleasure, and the quality of what you get, that kind of chunkiness, the freshness, I'm really loving it.
Do you think foods taste different when you grind them in that mortar and pestle?
Now, call me a romantic, but I do. I do. I am a romantic. I think that it's not, you know, you're not chopping, you're pulverizing, crushing, bruising. And so I think you don't get, with ingredients like garlic and basil even, you don't get the bitterness that you might get. And the color stays better, I think, as well. You know, it's funny. Our son grabs the mortar and pestle and uses it to muddle herbs and things that he might when he's making cocktails.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's really funny because he looked at it and he says, oh, it's a muddler. I said, no, it's not a muddler. It's a mortar and pestle. But muddling's become so very chic now with all of the kind of designer cocktails. But I think things do taste fresher. And it's the texture as well. It's not as uniform. And that's really, really nice.
Mm-hmm. What kind do you like best? Because there's stone and there's marble. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. there's ceramic. And the scariest for me is glass. There's no way I'm pounding glass on glass. But for you, what do you prefer?
Well, the little one I had was marble. And it was fine. I had a wood one. Don't ask me why. I really don't recommend that because they're really hard to clean. Anything you put in wood, the wood retains the oils.
Mm-hmm.
I have a stone one now, and this is the one that I have such a crush on. You know, it's heavy, and the pestle is heavy, so it's very efficient. You don't have to work so hard, and it really it just feels good in your hand. And, you know, I remember when I first started cooking, I remember reading that pesto needed to be made in a mortar and pestle. And I thought, well, you know, that's nice, but
yeah,
no.
But
and I always did it in the blender or the food processor. But, you know, pesto needs to be made in a mortar and pestle.
Hey, Dory, thank you.
It's been fun.
Dory Greenspan's latest book is Baking From My Home to Yours. Now, for a good pesto recipe to initiate your mortar and pestle, take a look at my classic Pesto of Genoa. It's on the website, splendidtable.org. And while you're there, be sure to check out all of our other offerings, podcasts, newsletters, and information on our latest book, How to Eat Supper. Coming up, Cheese Man Steve Jenkins talks the food life and putting veggie burgers to the taste test. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, the show about life's appetites. The word pioneer gets thrown around a lot when hyping culinary types, yet sometimes it's right on. It does apply to New York cheesemonger Steve Jenkins. You've heard Steve on the show for years, and the reason he's here is that he is a pioneer. 30 years ago, he was tracking artisan cheeses when nobody was sure what that word meant. Steve came of professional age in a New York that was bursting with America's first flush of food fascination. Well, he tells the story and much more in his book, The Food Life. Steve, good to have you back.
Hi, Lynn. Great to be with you.
You know, I've realized something. In all the years that we've been talking to each other on the air, I've never asked you how you got started in the food business and how you got into cheese. Tell me where this epic began.
Began when I was 24 in 1975, and I was coming back from a role I played at the theater at Gainesville, Florida.
Oh, you were an actor.
Yeah, I got a degree in theater at the University of Missouri. Hell, that was the only way I'd get a degree if I was doing something fun, because I wasn't going to study for anything else, that's for sure. So I got my idiot degree in theater, and I moved to New York shortly after my mother finally said after a year, well, why don't you just go? So I packed up my speaker columns and record albums and moved to New York. I didn't know anybody here. I didn't know nothing from nobody. I'd only been here once. So anyway, I was coming back from playing Teddy and When You're Coming Back, Red Rider, and I pulled into town with my car spewing white smoke. I broke down on the turnpike, and I'd given up my apartment. I'd lost my girlfriend. I didn't have a job. I was broke. And I said to myself, this is not fun, and I'm not boy enough to withstand the vagaries of trying to be an actor. So I got a job in a cheese shop, and I decided to just take it to the max and show up early and stay late and scrub and sweep and wear an apron all day and do the best I could. And I didn't know anything about food. I didn't know anything certainly about cheese. And after a year or two, ended up being the general manager of like three of these little shops and still didn't know anything about food and certainly nothing about cheese. And I got fired because I told the owner that I was in one of the shops when I was really in my apartment. So I was out of work, and a guy I knew said, well, go down to Dean and DeLuca. It's this new shop in Soho. I didn't even know where Soho was. I hadn't even been to Soho, and I'd lived in New York City for like 3 years. What a putz I was in those days. And I went down to this address on Prince Street at Wooster, and I was Joel Dean's and Giorgio DeLuca's first hire for the store that became known as Dean and DeLuca in Soho.
Goodness sake. Now, I think for people who don't know about Dean and DeLuca, and especially about Dean and DeLuca then in the 70s, maybe you better explain its significance.
Well, before Dean and DeLuca, there was nothing. I mean, there was Zabar's, but that was just for smoked fish and people on the Upper West Side, and really nothing else as far as serious imported and domestic foods for people who considered themselves serious cooks. There were no serious cooks. Julia Child was just getting started pretty much in those days. There was nobody that traveled, nobody that cared about cooking for their friends, or at least certainly not anybody that was written about or that was writing books or whatever. It was this huge wasteland in New York of some real high-end French restaurants that nobody could afford to go to, and really nothing else. Then there was Little Italy. You know, it was horrible red sauce and nothing that made any sense.
I liked that red sauce.
You did not. The food scene was non-existent in 77 when Dean and DeLuca started. And there was Balducci's. They were doing a pretty darn good job. I take that back. But it was Dean and DeLuca that began to get the attention of all the writers and artists, painters and designers and hipsters, if you will, that predated the 80s. And by golly, we changed everything because of what we did with food. We turned it into theater. We took everything out from behind glass and out of the refrigerators and put it on countertops. And I began to start my signage fetish, where I would write what an item was and why it was significant rather than just its title misspelled and some idiot price on it. And we just began to snowball into all this publicity and all these beautiful people. This was even before beautiful people, man. and we began to pioneer all these things that have become staples: balsamic vinegar, serious olive oil, not to mention the great cheeses of the world that I did just because nobody had ever done it before. And I want to emphasize, I'm not bragging. I mean, I never had an original thought in my entire 33-year career. Everything I've done or that's been regarded as an accomplishment by me has been something I stole, something I mimicked. So this is not bragging. This is just historical fact. And you know, that's going on three and a half decades ago that Americans began to get serious about food. And it didn't happen in Napa and Sonoma and San Francisco. It happened in New York City, baby.
Back in the 70s, you started bringing in from Europe artisan-made cheeses, from very small producers.
Yeah.
How did you get those producers to trust you? And secondly, how did you get those cheeses into the country? Because I don't know that those cheeses were something that inspectors were used to looking at.
I smuggled them. I purely and simply smuggled them. Nothing that I did. I would just order them from people. I often had to pay them up front. I would get all my European stuff, not yet the Italian, just the French stuff, from the big, huge, enormous market. And I began to order all of these cheeses that I had begun to read about that had never been in New York before, just because I knew they were important. And the USDA and USFDA and customs people were so overwhelmed with whatever, or understaffed, whatever they were doing at the time, that they didn't pay any attention to my orders. All that's changed now. We're in a great deal of scrutiny, and I can't bend any rules, but I still am able to get my hands on what I want. Had to pay those guys up front in most cases and had to throw away a lot of it. Most of this stuff came in under the aegis of Fairway by this time. This is like 1980 now.
You've gone from Dean and DeLuca through another job and then to Fairway Markets.
Yeah.
So, Stephen, now it's today. Artisan is a catchword practically. Farm-made, handmade, it's all over the place.
Yeah.
What are you aiming for now? What's the future?
The future is the same as the past. Continue to support that family, that young couple that is doing their thing the old way and by hand and with a great deal of respect and expertise so that they can have a meaningful life and get happy and have something to pass on to their kids. I support the artisan. I support small production, things that aren't so refined. Things that are at least in the idiom of the way things always were four, five, six centuries ago.
Mm-hmm.
Things that are worthy of being on my wife Michelle's and my table for the people that we most love to be around. And, you know, that's the most important time in life, Lynn, and you agree with me, is the time that you spend at the table with the people that you love to be around, mm-hmm. as opposed to going out to some dopey restaurant and being treated like you're lucky to be there and spending way too much money when you ought to be having patronized your local market, taken it home, cooked it up in your own glorious kitchen, and served it on your own glorious table for your own glorious friends.
Stephen, thank you.
Lynn, thank you.
Cheesemonger Steve Jenkins is author of The Food Life. Now you can find Steve's recipe for 2 cucumber and cheese salad on the website, splendidtable.org. Culinary obsessive that I am, I'm a pushover for taste comparisons. I mean, when I put down my cash, I want to know I'm getting something good, not just okay. So all of us on the show eat veggie burgers, so we figured why not do a taste test. Technical director Jenny Lubke, producer Jennifer Russell, and Moy convened in my kitchen, because I was the only one who had six skillets, by the way. And we laid out a stack of six different brands of veggie burgers. Then the challenge began. We were terribly scientific.
Would you like to comment on the frozen patty appearance?
All right, the one that has to go under the broiler is very pretty. It looks like peas and carrots.
Yes.
Now this one, number 5, looks exactly like a hamburger. It's brown, looks like brown meat, and so does number 3.
It does.
All right, so you're going to keep track of the numbers. I don't know the brands. Right?
Okay.
Okay, so this one takes the longest.
Preheat oven on broil. Do not add any shortening. Broil 8 to 10 minutes on each
That's
side.
That's creating a charcoal briquette.
I know.
All right, I'm turning on the oven.
Okay, and here are our microwave specimens.
All right, that can go on this plate. And we'll put it, how long are they microwaving?
Let's see. One burger, 1.5 to 2 minutes.
On high?
Yes.
Okay, oh, that's great.
And we'll turn it halfway through. So
all right.
Why don't we do a minute on one side.
And half a minute on the other.
All right. Now we have 3 to 4 minutes per side on these 4 veggie burgers that are in their skillets.
3 to 4 minutes per side?
Yes.
Okay. I told everyone a 6-burner stove was essential to my life. Okay. Yeah, get that warmed up. The grill marks on 4 are kind of fun. Ooh.
Oh!
Did you do that just for sound effects? That was awesome.
The aromas are fabulous.
They
that one smelled like soy sauce.
Most of them have directions for the barbecue as well. So summertime.
Yeah. Now my thought would be to give them the lightest brushing with a good organic oil like canola, something that doesn't have a lot of flavor or a little olive oil, because I just think they'd crisp a little faster on a grill.
Ooh. I think everybody should know that Lynn Rossetto Casper has a lava lamp in her kitchen.
My husband collects them.
Oh. Okay, here goes.
It is time to flip our broiled burger. Oh. It looks pretty anemic.
Wow.
Okay, I'm going to give it 5 minutes on the other side.
Great.
All right.
Now, this is funny because as the vegetarian in the group, I eat a fair amount of veggie burgers in my house, and I have never paid such close attention to the appearance. It's really
interesting. You have to know no one in their right mind pays this kind of close attention, only when you're doing this kind of work. You see why I say my life is not about reality?
No.
You are
truly a woman who is obsessed.
Yes, lamentably.
Well, all six burgers did get cooked according to the directions on their packages. We dished them up and dug in. Now, we tasted each one carefully. None were bad, but two really stood out for me.
This one has flecks of green. This is number four, and it looks like it has corn niblets in it. Oh, I'd swear I taste pinto beans or something like that. This has less salt than most. You can taste grain and beans. Mmm. Number five is, again, a burger that looks like a hamburger. This is very good. It's mouth-filling and meaty and very tasty. Mmm.
Sounds like they're getting better as you're going along.
They really are. None of them would I say are bad. But I would say for pure meatiness and really tasty, number five. For more of a veggie burger experience, number four. So what are they? What have you been tasting?
Are you ready?
I'm ready.
Okay. Number five is Amy's. It's the all-American veggie burger.
Okay. Let me see. Ah, okay. Amy's, well-known brand. Oh, it's organic. Made with vegetables and grains. Main ingredient, organic onions, organic mushrooms, wheat gluten, textured soy protein, concentrate, bulgur wheat, walnuts. Oh, yeah. Okay. That's the meaty burger.
That's the meaty burger.
Now, what about number four?
Number four was the Boca meatless burger with grilled vegetables.
Ah. These are called soy protein burgers. And it says low fat, low cholesterol, high protein, and zero trans fats. That's very nice. Okay, so those are our two winners.
They were Amy's All-American Veggie Burger and Boca's Meatless Burger with Grilled Vegetables. Now, one other burger was really good, but you couldn't compare it in the competition. It was Trader Joe's Vegetable Masala Burger. Essentially, it was a spiced Indian potato pea patty. Well, now, you can find a list of the sampled burgers and the winners on the website, splendidtable.org. Food writer and editor Jean Anderson has eased nearly two generations of timid souls into good cooking with her books and her articles. She's one of those professionals professional. What I didn't know about Jean, though, is that she's had a 40-year love affair with Southern food. Even though she was born in the South, her Yankee parents never cooked Southern. So she scarfed up school cafeteria food and cadged invites to her friends' homes. Well, now this delight has come full circle. Jean's latest book is A Love Affair with Southern Cooking, Recipes and Recollections. Jean, it's good to talk to you.
Oh, Lynn, thanks. It's good to talk to you, too.
Yeah, I want to talk about old-time Southern picnic menus. Could you give us a picture of what a Southern picnic was then?
Oh, boy. They were really wonderful, Lynn. I mean, a complete education for me. In the county where I worked, August was picnic month, and there was a picnic every night, sometimes two. They were held usually on church grounds or maybe school grounds or clubhouse grounds, and they would improvise tables. They'd put up two befores and lay, you know, boards across them and then maybe cover them with newspapers, or sometimes just a colorful sheet would be put down. And then every club member would bring her most, well, we call place of pride dish, the thing that she was famous for. And it might be wild persimmon pudding. It might be yellow squash pudding. It might be a pound cake. It might be a fresh coconut cake.
Oh, brother.
Yeah, it was just, you know, I mean, imagine, you know, like four dozen dishes just laid out on all of these improvised tables. And this is the first time I had tasted wild persimmon pudding. I'd never heard of that in Raleigh. And I never had had Jerusalem artichoke pickles. I didn't even know what Jerusalem artichokes were. It was a wonderful education.
You're bringing this up to today. Picnicking is still going on, right?
Oh, you bet. Absolutely.
And the church and suppers and that kind of thing.
Church suppers, political fundraisers, huge cookouts. And what they often do, I mean, you know, if there's an army to feed, they will do one of the sort of classic Southern muddles, and they'll cook them in wash tubs, or they will cook them in, you know, big old iron pots.
Wait. But hold it. A muddle. You've got to translate for this northerner.
Well, a muddle usually is just a muddle of different ingredients. It could be chicken-based, it could be pork-based, it could be fish or shellfish-based. And I think they started really back almost in the days of the Revolution. One of the first muddles that I know about is one that's called pine bark stew. And this is a Lowcountry, South Carolina recipe that was made by the soldiers under the command of the Swamp Fox, and that was Francis Marion.
Oh, yeah.
And camping out, as they did all through the Lowcountry, they would grab whatever fish or shellfish they could find and throw it into a big pot, throw in onions, probably wild onions pulled right out of the ground, tomatoes, butter beans, whatever they had, and that was a muddle. And then later there was Brunswick stew. That was County, Virginia, although Brunswick, Georgia disputes that. But the Virginia one, I think, is the first, and that was 1828. And that, again, was by a camp cook who was cooking for a bunch of hunters. And Chicken Bog is another one.
Bog, what a romantic name.
Isn't it? But I think it's a wonderful dish today if you're feeding a whole lot of people because it is very quick and easy, and it's economical.
How does it come together?
Well, it starts really basically with, you know, like browning onions and peppers, usually in oil or lard they would have used in the old days. And then throwing in, well, this is chicken-based, but also it's really like a very wet pilaf. So it's a rice-based dish. And this is another dish that came out of the South Carolina Lowcountry.
Jean, picnic table or outdoor family reunion gathering, are there one or two other dishes that you would always find on the table, no matter where you are in the South?
Well, certainly coleslaw. It might be the classic sort of creamy coleslaw, or it might be a newer slaw, which is called barbecue slaw, which is oil and vinegar based, but has a touch of ketchup in it and some chili peppers, so it's a hot slaw.
Uh-huh.
I would say black-eyed pea salad is another one that's very popular, but if you're having fried chicken, that would be potato salad. Green tomato pie.
Mm-hmm.
Really, really good. Made much the way you would make an apple pie, but you use green tomatoes instead of apples. Pound cake, always. It could be just a classic pound cake, or it could be a Kentucky bourbon cake, which is essentially a pound cake, the only liquid ingredient, 3/4 of a cup of Kentucky's finest. Really, really, really delicious.
Jean, thank you.
Thank you, Lynn.
Jean Anderson is the author of A Love Affair with Southern Cooking, Recipes and Recollections. Now, Jean left us a leg up for pulling together a Southern-style picnic with two recipes, chicken bog to feed a crowd and sweet slaw. Now, you can find them on the website, splendidtable.org. Well, it's time for this week's trivia challenge. Now, the question is, what ancient love potion recipe calls for octopus? We're going to have that answer in a moment, and we're going to be opening the lines for your calls. You can get to us at 800-537-5252. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. Now, we're going to be opening the lines for your calls in a moment. The number is 800-537-5252. But first, I've got the answer to this week's trivia challenge. Now, the question was, what love potion calls for octopus? Well, that famous sayer of sooth, Nostradamus, was an apothecary before he realized that there was more to be gained by becoming a prophet of doom.
In his pharmacy days, he made up a love jam, and he published it in his book, A Treatise on Makeup and Jam, a bestseller, no doubt. Anyway, the love jam recipe included standard apple pie spices, sugar, wine, and octopus. But wait, the rest of the recipe gets far better. You need the blood of 7 sparrows, male sparrows, bled through the left wing, mandrake apples picked at sunrise, and something called bee's laughter. You cook this all together over an open fire, but woe unto you if it is a willow fire. Why do I think that Nostradamus didn't date much?
Hello? Hey, what's going on? How come I never see you around no more? Where you been? Yeah, well, you should call me. When? Well, I get all my messages. I never got any from you.
Okay, it's time to open the lines for your calls. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. Anything goes. Okay, we have got Kate on the line from Santa Fe. Hey, Kate, what's happening? What do you want to talk about?
Hi, Lynn. I want to talk about currants. I just bought a house, and I inherited 2 beautiful big currant bushes that are full of fruit.
Ooh.
I've only used dried currants in baking or things like that.
Right.
Wondered if you had any suggestions.
Well, first of all, they dry beautifully, and you're in Santa Fe, which means you've got that dry, dry climate.
Exactly.
So drying's a great idea, but currants make fabulous jam. Mm-hmm. They're tart, as well as they can be sweet tart, and sometimes they're very tart.
Yeah,
how do yours taste?
Tart.
Yours are very tart?
Yes.
Well, one of the things that they're great in is savory dishes.
Mm.
So let me give you an idea.
Okay.
You've got that great local lamb in your farmer's market, from what I recall.
Mm-hmm.
Imagine if you took a piece of that lamb and you slow pan broiled it, right?
Mm-hmm.
And you threw some of those currants in the pan with a little bit of red wine and maybe a tad of sugar.
Okay.
And when the lamb is done, that goes into the pan. You could even add a little garlic and you simmer that down and simmer that down until the sugar and the wine almost caramelize and the currants have kind of melted into it. And you're going to get this sweet, tart, deeply rich because of the lamb juices and the red wine, almost syrupy,
oh,
lovely
yum.
Sauce for the lamb.
Could that work with any kind of fish also?
Oh, that would work brilliantly. I mean, imagine what that would be like with salmon.
Yeah.
And it would look spectacular.
Yeah.
You could do that with poultry.
Okay.
In fact, you know what you could do that with? You could do that with vegetables, for goodness sakes. Imagine green beans,
mm-hmm.
and you cook them. Essentially, there's a wonderful Mediterranean way of doing green beans where essentially you take really fresh green beans, you take a big skillet, you film it with olive oil, good-tasting olive oil.
Mm-hmm.
You throw in the beans, give them some salt, and you cover the pan, and you cook them just in their own natural moisture. Maybe they've been washed, so there's some drops of water,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
and you let them get to the point where they're silky and limp.
Oh,
not mush,
mm-hmm.
but they're not crisp at all.
Yeah.
Now lift them out of there, or toward the end of the cooking, throw in those currants. And maybe if you want that little bit of sugar, but maybe you don't want it at all. Maybe you just want that sour currant
mm-hmm.
taste. And maybe some onion. And let that cook in, or pull them out of the pan, leaving some of the oil behind. And then do a sauté of the currants with sugar and maybe some white wine or vinegar.
Ah, yeah.
Because then you have a salad.
Yeah, that's true. That's true.
And that brings me to the other thing you can do with them. Puree them with olive oil.
I'm so excited.
Yeah, but puree them with olive oil and vinegar in a salad.
Ah.
That would be fabulous.
So that would be your dressing, basically.
Well, yeah. And you could use that over lettuce. You could use that over anything.
It'll be good with, like, cheese.
And since you're in the land of dynamite chilies, I see no reason why you can't take currants and simmer them with a bit of, good local chili and maybe some sugar. Again, I keep thinking sweet tart, but
yeah.
things you would serve with savory dishes.
Yeah.
I mean, you can almost make like a currant chutney.
Yes, yes.
Wouldn't that
would
be fabulous?
Great.
And then you could store it in the freezer.
Oh, that would be brilliant.
And you could pull that out in the winter. It would taste fabulous. And the other thing, just freeze them straight.
Oh.
They're traditionally used with game. They're used with bold flavored foods. But I've always found them to be really, really, really wonderful with even really delicate things like, you know, if you were to just cook them in a little bit of sugar, maybe with some cinnamon, and when you get really good vanilla yogurt, frozen yogurt, or ice cream, you just drizzle that over it, and it just tastes fabulous.
Oh, you're so helpful. Thank you so much.
Well, you're also living in Nirvana. You know, you have all those things to pull from.
I feel very, very lucky. And I also want to tell you that I am working through your new cookbook this summer, slowly using all of the recipes, and it is amazing. It is such a great cookbook.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. And I didn't have to pay you all that much to say that. I'm so glad.
No, you paid me nothing.
Hey, keep enjoying the book, Kate, and thanks for a great question.
Thanks.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye. 800-537-5252. We've got Jenny calling from Nashville. Jenny, what do you want to talk about?
Well, hi. I wanted to talk about tomatoes and ice cream.
Oh.
I have an ice cream shop in Nashville, and we make all of our own ice cream, and it's a really fun place. And we have a tomato festival in our neighborhood.
Uh-huh.
We would really like to participate with some tomato sorbet or ice cream or even sherbet, but I'm just at a loss for just what to do. I've done a strawberry tomato in the past, and it's gone over pretty well, but it mostly tastes like strawberry.
Uh-huh.
And I really want something where the tomato can shine.
Okay, so here's the key. How do we get real tomato flavor? Because it's a fruit.
Yes.
And, you know, if you think about it, you can do tomato jam, right? I mean, tomatoes and sugar, when the tomatoes are really good.
Yes.
Okay, what I recall about making ice cream, there are two different schools of ice cream. One is the custard base with egg yolks and you cook it. And the other one is the base where you just have the fruit and cream and sugar and whatever flavorings you want.
Right.
Well, just because I know with fruit especially, when you start fooling around with eggs, I think it mutes the fruit. So I would use the other technique.
Okay.
And what I would want to do is take the tomatoes, and you need really tasty tomatoes, first of all. Forget the Romas. Forget most of the paste tomatoes. Taste them before you buy them.
Sure.
And if they have very high sugar and high acid, they're going to hold up best.
Right.
Because, as you know better than any of us, when you freeze something in ice cream, the flavors really get muted by the cold.
Yeah. Well, and it seems like spices are really brought up, and then fruits and other things are really sort of brought down. And so that's one of the hardest things I'm finding is I did a tomato, orange, and cardamom kind of as a test run, and it was lovely, but it just tasted like cardamom.
Did you cook the tomato first or just put it in raw?
I did cook the tomato. I wanted the skins off, and so I took the tomato and cooked it, took the skins out, and then pureed it with some orange. And then I added the cardamom, and that was actually a sorbet. So what I found with the cream is I really couldn't taste the tomato at all.
Yeah.
So that's one of the things that I'm just like, what type of tomato would be best to use and what kind of thing.
Tell me some of the names of tomatoes you've got in your area.
I feel like we have a lot of these great big tomatoes. I could go with an heirloom. That still might be a little mild, though.
Okay, this is what you're going to do. You're going to go to the market and taste the tomatoes.
Okay.
You know, buy a few. I would bet you off the top of my head, Brandywine is too delicate. That's one of the favorite, you know, heirlooms.
Sure.
But I would imagine Rutgers, Big Boy, Early Boy, these are all good bets on this. Amish paste, by the way, could be, it's a paste tomato, but it can have a lot of flavor. Oxheart can have a lot of flavor. And this is what I would do. I would cook the tomatoes, seeds, peel, and all. Just chunk it up. With sugar, part of the sugar you would need in your formula.
Okay.
And a generous pinch of salt.
Okay.
And I would simmer that in a skillet so that I get it almost, not quite to a jam consistency, but really thick and really concentrated. You want to be just have pure tomato. And then you could puree it, but what might be better is put it through a food mill.
Sure.
So you get rid of all the seeds and the skin. But that seed and skin is going to give it flavor. That's why you don't want to peel them before you cook it.
Sure.
And then use a pound of that to, let's say, a cup of cream.
Okay.
half a cup maybe of sugar. I'm just thinking basic formula, but you know, again, you know what works.
Sure.
And you may want to add maybe a little ginger to it. You may want to add a little orange. You may want to add, I mean, you could even do basil.
Well, I thought about basil, and that, how should I process the basil? Should I cook it in with the tomato mixture?
Don't cook that. That, I think what I would do is just dip in sugar syrup, pull out, and put it in pieces.
Okay.
See what you get. The other thing you could think about doing is a basil sorbet with chunks of zebra tomato. You know those green tomatoes that really taste rich and delicious?
Yeah.
And you could drop chunks of that tomato into a heavy sugar syrup and let it cook for just a few minutes, because the sugar, a heavy sugar syrup, is going to pull the moisture out of the fruit but keep it intact.
Wonderful.
And then you could have the green tomato in a basil sorbet. It could,
okay,
really
that
be cool,
great.
Wouldn't it?
Now I have so many things to try. I'm going to be so busy.
Hey, well, hey, enjoy. I wish, oh, it sounds like a great festival. It'd be great to come down and just sample.
Oh,
with
and
you.
It's lots of fun. We're yeah. celebrating all things tomato in this year.
Here, here.
Well, hey. Thank you so much. I
oh, Jenny,
it.
You're welcome. And let us know how it works out.
Thank you. I will.
You okay. Take care.
Thanks. You too.
Bye. 800-537-5252. We have Shauna calling from San Francisco. Shauna, what do you want to talk about?
Hey, Lynn. Oh, this is so exciting. I love your show.
Thank you.
Well, I'm calling in because I've gotten into jam making, and I had a couple questions for you.
Okay.
Last summer, I started doing some strawberry jam, and then this year I did some peach jam. And my question basically has to do with the sugar content of some of these recipes. You can get cavities just reading how
yeah,
much
yeah. Mm-hmm.
sugar is required to make them, and because the summer fruits are so great, I was just kind of wondering how low can I go? Like, how much sugar can I cut out of a recipe before I really start affecting the quality of the final product?
Well, the quality in terms of taste can be toyed with a great deal, and you can cut way back on sugar. The preserve side of it is what suffers if you want to preserve it just in jars, because that cooking in the sugar essentially knocks out certain microbes that can develop into harmful bacteria or are potentially harmful. Now, if you can freeze the jam, you see, then you've got all kinds of things open to you. First of all, you can use, I think they call it quick-set pectin or concentrated pectin. You know, one of the things is that one of the reasons you're cooking is to reduce the moisture in the fruit so that it thickens and makes a jam.
Right.
You could keep, now, whenever you cook a fruit, you change its structure and you change its taste. So if you wanted to just, let's say, do chunks of peaches or a puree of peaches where you don't cook it at all and you sweeten it to taste, but you add pectin to it, this concentrated pectin that needs no heat to be activated, that will thicken the jam. There are usually instructions on the containers of this pectin. And you could add seasonings to it, you know, like you could make it with cinnamon or whatever, and you add the amount of sugar you want. And I think you let it sit out for a period of time until it stiffens, and then you have to refrigerate it. Obviously, in the refrigerator, it's not going to keep a super long time, but you can freeze it.
Right. So basically, if I cut too much sugar, it's no longer like a preserve. It's
that's right. You have some danger of harmful bacteria developing.
Right.
But if you're not aiming to store it at room temperature in a jar, right,
okay,
I would still put it in a sterile jar.
Yeah.
Always, just to be on the safe side. And if you have a freezer room, you can freeze it.
I just would have to use pectin.
You'd use pectin only if you think you need to have it thickened.
Okay.
You follow me?
Right.
If if you're not going to cook it at all. If you're going to cook that fruit down a bit, just use your own sugar to taste and freeze it.
Okay.
The pectin is only there when you think you need it to be stabilized because you're not cooking it at all, and it's runny.
Okay.
So that's the basic. And by the way, runny jam is not a bad thing.
I guess the only thing then you'd have to worry about is you wouldn't be able to give it as gifts as easily if you didn't use...
No.
Right.
No, you wouldn't. But if you freeze it in something fairly attractive or freeze it in a way that you can be giving it in that container with a note saying, you know, this is defrosted, you have to use it within a week.
Okay.
And store in the refrigerator.
Gotcha.
It's going to taste like, you know, that classic statement, summer in a jar.
Yeah.
it's going to be great.
Yeah.
So that's the basic theory. You know, there's a reason why there always is that amount of sugar in these recipes.
Okay.
And it's for the safety.
All right.
Okay.
Well, great. Thank you so much, Lynn.
Hey, you take care.
All right, you too.
Bye.
Bye.
Well, that's the show for this week. Thanks for joining us. And remember, you can call us anytime. The number is 800-537-5252. You have a great week. And until next time, let me leave you with this quote from Charles Kingsley, who said, "All the ingenious men and all the scientific men in the world could not invent, if all their wits were boiled into one, anything so curious and so ridiculous as the lobster." The Splendid Table is produced by American Public Media and supported by Gather.com, the social network with substance where people connect around their interests. You can join the conversation about cooking at Gather.com. Now, information on everything you heard here today can be found on our website, splendidtable.org. Have a visit. You'll find podcasts, newsletters, a recipe archive from our very talented guests, and information on our book, How to Eat Supper. Also at splendidtable.org is the Splendid Table store, where you can find products related to cooking and baking. Our show is produced by Jennifer Russell with help from Andrew Schumacher and Judy Boudreau. Our technical director is Jennifer Lubke. Our website is managed by Brett Baldwin. Our managing producer is Sally Swift. You have a great week, and please join us next time. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper.
American Public Media.
I'm Tanya Mosley. In 1987, my sister Anita vanished without a trace. Decades later, thanks to DNA, we found her. But that's only the beginning of the story. She Has a Name is a new audio documentary that explores the search for redemption, confronting trauma, and healing in the face of unimaginable loss. Subscribe now to Truth Be Told Presents She Has a Name, where every revelation brings us closer to the truth.